So as President Trump has committed, we're going to deputize every U.S. citizen in this country to help us find 340,000 missing children, because we need the public's help on this. Every mom and dad knows what it's like. They have a gut feeling when they see something out there in the public that there's something ain't right with that child. So we're going to deputize every one of them to help us find these children.
I like that. I mean, he says that, there are 340,000 kids missing. That's Tom Homan, incoming border czar. Welcome back to the program. Dana Loesch with you. And you can find us, Channel 347 DirecTV as well. The chat's at Rumble. If you're not listening, coast to coast. The deputizing of America, I'm good with that. You know, again, I mentioned this yesterday. Just get out the GOB network, man. The good old boy network.
That's right.
All Tom Homan needs to do is put that searchlight in the sky with the silhouette of a mullet, and the GOB network, they're going to find these kids. This is how it works, man. Put it into practice. I mean, we got a Doge, for crying out loud. We need a GOB network. That's how that needs to happen. You could just empower average everyday citizens to go and do what they need to do in order to not only find these kids, but maybe get rid of the drone issue. I don't know, like all kinds of stuff. And so, the numbers keep going up. It's several hundred thousand. That's how much we know. It's several hundred thousand kids missing. And I just, for the Democrats were so concerned about kids at one point, remember? So let's go back to when it was Obama, Biden, and they were allowing everybody and their brother to come through the border. They were allowing everybody to come in, right? And so at some point, it ended up that they were unable to confirm whether or not some of the minors traveling with some of these adults, whether or not they were actually like with the adults, whether or not they were actually part of it, this family group. And so they separated them and they held them for X amount of hours while they determined that the child that a group of adults was bringing with them across the border to take advantage of the Flores Amendment, which was fast tracking them because they had youth, then they had to determine whether or not that they were legitimately like a family and not, you know, some rando who was trafficking a kid across the border. And nobody on the left said anything about that. So Trump comes in and is dealing with the border and kept that practice in place until they could get rid of the Flores Amendment that Obama had put in. And then Democrats are like, oh my gosh, the kids at the border, they're putting them in cages. And then they went at Trump for a policy that Barack Obama literally created and had to create because he had opened the border, that it was difficult for them to deal with the deluge that was coming in. So now we have 340,000 some odd missing kids, actual kids brought over by coyotes or adults or who knows. And all those people that were real upset about the kids in cages, they don't care about them kids no more. Do you see AOC down at the border crying over anybody? Do you see her at the detention center when people are bringing kids across the border? Do you see her at any one of the places in the interior of the United States of America to where these, apparently the paperwork says these kids are apparently being shipped to? You don't see her there pretending to cry, bending over with her hand pressed up to her face because she is in such great extreme distress emotionally. They don't care about these kids. They don't give a rat's ass about these kids. You don't hear anybody on the left talking about the missing kids. They don't care. Oh, they pretended to care so much about the kids in cages from Obama. And then Trump ended that, by the way. They pretended to care so much about that, but oh, they don't care about these missing kids, what? Now, don't you find that incredibly ironic? And also hypocritical. And it also betrays their stated purpose of complaining. Because it's not about the kids at all. They don't care if it's their admin. How much you want to bet that they try to pin this on Trump, too, after he takes office in January? What about these missing kids, Trump? You're going to hear it. I guarantee you. Mark my word. You're going to hear it. They're going to do it like they did it by blaming him with the kids in cages. They're going to do the same thing. By the way, you wouldn't have kids in cages if you just didn't allow every Tom, Dick, and Harry to come in. And, oh, you got a kid? You get to go up to the front of the line. This is not like bringing a can of food to your kid's assembly, right? Oh, if you bring a kid to the border, you'll get fast tracked. They treated it like that, though, did they not? They absolutely treated it like that. Just unbelievable. But it betrays their stated purpose. They don't care about any of those. Have you guys heard of trans blind?
What?
No, it is not a type of window blind.
Oh, is it?
No. It's a new alphabet flag. Trans blind is a trans-abled identity where someone desires to physically lose sight from an eye or from both eyes or to a physical non-blind individual who internally feels or identifies as blind without necessarily desiring to become. Oh my gosh.
Why?
I would say it's reality blind. Why do people, why did they make a flag for people who can't see?
That doesn't make sense, does it?
I mean, that's the first obvious question. If it's supposed to be trans blind, you're appropriating blindness. Why would you make a flag that they can't see?
Right.
Like, y'all didn't even try to put Braille up in this. What in the world? That doesn't make any sense, does it?
No.
There was a story that I found. Someone had shared. It's from a few years ago. Speaking of trans blind, this woman identified as trans blind. And back then, and this was in 2015, they called it body integrity identity disorder. Now it's just trans blind. What other people would call crazy. All right. You can put all these words and affix it to it. B is crazy. All right. 30-year-old woman in North Carolina. This is back in 2015. She had wanted to be blind since she was a little girl. So she poured drain cleaner in her eyes. Didn't get medical attention and lost her vision. She is now almost completely blind. And she says that this is the way I was supposed to be born. And they write in the piece, and it's Women's Health Mag that has the story. They write in the piece that she, because she wanted to be blind, and she says it's the way I was supposed to be. They go, it's insane. And she suffers from a condition called body integrity identity disorder. And it makes people that they're supposed to be disabled. Like people who want to be paraplegic, that's a thing. That's a real thing. And so it's trans something. So this is trans blind. I think they call it trans-abled or something, or trans, I don't know what they call it. It's an actual thing. I went down the rabbit hole. It's wild. So what? I mean... I have no words, Kane.
I don't have many more than that.
I don't have any. I can't even believe just. I mean, all they got to do. You don't have to pour drain cleaner in your eyes. Can't you just close your eyes?
Close your eyes.
You dummy.
They sell those pirate patches, too. They sell pirate patches. You can get not only for Halloween, but you can buy them at the medical store, too.
Yeah.
Get those eye patches.
Get you an eye patch. It's super simple.
And then if you ever feel like later you want to reverse this trans blind desire, you just take the patch off, and then you're good.
Why doesn't anyone ever, Kane, as you know, go, I'm a trans billionaire.
Right.
I identify as a billionaire. Give me my money.
Give me my plane.
You're hurting my mental health by not giving me $1 billion.
Where's my FAA authorized takeoff on my private plane?
Where's my G6? Come on.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, you see what I'm saying? Like they, just give me the money or it's hurting my mental health. Why can't I say that and make that happen? Why can't any of you? I identify as a, I'm a trans billionaire. I'm saying that now. That's official. I'm identifying as a billionaire. I need my money to affirm my wealth.
I just think you're dreaming small. I'm a trans trillionaire. And you know, whatever you're doing is fine if that's what you want to do. But
wait, does that mean that that's a bigger identity box than mine?
Yeah.
Well, what's after trillionaire? Quadrillionaire?
Yeah.
Okay, can I be that?
You can be that if you want to. I mean, you're only doing it because I'm a trans.
No, I really feel that way. I really identify
I
like
think
that.
I feel like you're doing it just because I became a trans trillionaire.
Yeah, but you just can't become it. You got to feel it.
I feel it.
I feel like you're appropriating.
I feel like I'm becoming it.
But I feel like you're appropriating, though.
I don't know. Not sure that's how it's going down.
I love when people say that, too. When they're like, I feel like that's just them trying to be they're trying to soften the blow of bitchery. That's what, I really feel like, no, just say it. Just say it. You don't feel like that. Obviously, that's redundant because you're saying an opinion. So you feel that way. You moron. Stop saying it. I really feel like, shut up. I feel like, trans blind. Just close your eyes. Put a headband on. Get one of them headbands on Amazon. Pull it over your face. You know, it'd probably be an improvement for some of them. Just pull it over your face. You know, there's this crazy invention that they made. I don't know when they made it, came. But it's really amazing. Real modern, yeah. Right? I guess they don't have them where these people come from. But it's a like a pillow shaped like sunglasses, and it has a strap on it. And you can put it on your head over your eyes.
Wow.
Yeah, some people use it when they sleep, you know, to get the... I take it on red eyes. It's an amazing invention. These people should meet it.
Pretty common invention, though, right? It's not...
No, these people don't know it exists. I mean, they're willing to pour bleach in their damn eyes, for crying out loud. They don't know it exists. Clearly. How many flags are there? Hang on.
Oh, my.
I'm afraid to
it's
look at this.
It's unlimited, I'm sure, right? Just like the genders is unlimited, its flags are unlimited too, right?
Well, there's just pride flags also. That's like a whole thing. There's like 72 gender flags.
Oh.
And I know that the Department of Defense had put out something a little bit ago where they had, what were they talking about? They were mentioned some kind of, like, it was like some kind of woke flag that they had. And they put it out, and I'm like, why is the DOD doing this? Like, you want to know why you have problems with recruitment and all this other stuff. And they had, they put out something for what was like a trans flag, whatever day. I don't even know. But they said that there's what I don't know what a demiflux is or a gender puck, but these are things. 72 flags. There's 72 flags. 70, they said that there are 72 different genders.
That's 70 more.
I don't even think that the people who say that they're one of these genders know what the hell these flags are.
No, but there's not one person that could identify all of them and recognize them on sight. Like, there's so many.
I mean, what is the point of it? And then everybody wants government. They want government preference. Oh, there's mirror gender. Do you hear about this?
What?
So this sounds like a really bad superpower to have. You're changing your gender type based on the people that are surrounding you. It's like mystery men and completely lame powers that don't serve anybody. Like the guy who can be invisible, like but only when no one's looking.
It's like a gender chameleon?
Yeah. You can change your gender type based on the people around you.
So if I'm next to a woman, I can identify as a woman?
Yeah.
And then if I'm next to a guy, then I can then identify as a guy.
Yeah.
That's
stupid. I don't know about the magic that makes you morph a Frankenbeans or not, or have it demorph. Is that a word? Because it can be. I mean, hell, if they can create a flag, I can make up words. Why not? Everyone's Lewis Carroll today. I don't understand some of this stuff. Some of it I don't know. This is so, what's going to happen in like the future when, you know, people look back, like when we look back on people in the dark ages, what are they going to think when they look back on us? These people couldn't even figure out their genders. Look at all their flags. Like everybody has to have a flag. You could not tell me, all the people who advocate this, they could not tell me what all these flags stand for. 72 different ones. This is dumb.
And now, all of the news you would probably miss. It's time for Dana's Quick Five.
So, as I said earlier, Zuckerberg gave $1 million to Trump's inaugural fund. And so now have Sergey Brin and who else? The AI CEO. They've all, that's like $3 million that they've been able to bag for the inaugural fund. So, super interesting. Ontario is threatening to cut off U.S. energy exports if Trump makes good on his tariff plan. This coming in from MSN. Their most populous province has no plans to allow. They don't. They're obviously opposing the tariffs that he's promoting on Canadian goods if they don't help get the illegal immigration stuff under wraps. The Ontario Premier Doug Ford said his province was putting together a list of retaliatory measures and would go so far as to cut off energy exports if the POTUS-elect slapped Canadian products with a 25% tax as promised. You know, one of the things in the tariff discussion that everyone misses is why is every other country allowed to issue tariffs on our stuff, but we're not? And then they accuse us of not having a free market. if we put the same amount of restrictions or tariffs on products that they do. That doesn't make any sense to me. I don't understand why that's allowed to flourish as a narrative. People, oh, this is wild. A power outage stranded New York City subway riders during a storm. They had to go out and relieve themselves between the train cars. That's so gross. I mean, told you it smelled like pee and eggs down there, didn't I? The replica of the famous Christmas Story leg lamp was stolen from a Walmart store. Well, how much is it? I'm curious.
Fragile.
It's fragile, but it was made of, well, his was made of glass, but the ones you get are plastic. But they said that the window of a plumbing store, they had their leg lamp up and it was stolen. And they said, it's like the 4th of July and glorious, if you want to return it to them.
Why do you think Democrats lost, and what do you think needs to happen by the midterms and the next presidential election in order to find your footing again?
Well, Kristen, no disrespect to you. I think you do great work. But the reality is that those that tune in to our traditional news sources, they absolutely went for us. And we know that the standards that you have to live by as an actual journalist are completely different from other platforms. And so we know that we were winning for those that were tuning into the traditional news sources. But when it came down to people getting their news from places that really aren't even news sources, they were going for Donald Trump by 19 points. And that is exactly why we lost. The reality is that we're going to have to play in spaces that we've never had to play and make sure that we're communicating in all ways. Unfortunately, we can't just rely on the mainstream media to get our message across.
Well, I think she's a little late to the game, because when have Democrats ever really totally relied on mainstream media to get their message across? I mean, who do you think controls Hollywood? Who controls Hollywood? Who controls academia? This idea that it's just the media that is responsible for this, or that people are getting their, they can't rely on the mainstream media. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. She's an example of a person who just thinks that politics began the day that she was made self-aware, which is probably a couple of years ago. Let's be real. Right? It's one of the dumbest things ever. That's really stupid analysis that like ignores everything that media, everything that the left has been involved in. Right? So it ignores the entire system and bureaucracy of academia. It ignores the music industry, Kane. It ignores Hollywood, arts and entertainment, film, art, all of it, fashion. So this idea that, well, you know, we lost because we got to play in spaces we never had to play in before. What are you talking about? You mean you actually have to go and talk to the people? Notice that wasn't one of the things on our lips. You got to go and talk to the people? That's just stupid. She is not the brightest bulb in their box. She really isn't. I was listening to this and I thought, my gosh, they're going to keep losing because they have no idea why. They have no idea why they lost. That's just, and she says that, I guess what, you know, these places that they're not even news sources. And? They're not even news sources. What defines a news source? If you get news from something, is that a source from which you got your news? Who defines news source? Because I know Democrats have been wanting to define news sources as, goodness, that which validates their narrative. They've been wanting to do that for a long time. So is that really, it's just wanting to control media. It's wanting to control where the information comes from. That's all it is. It's wanting to control how people share information, what they share, how often they share it, etc. I just thought that was a really dumb soundbite. Didn't we just have a soundbite from her the other day where she was going off on the Daniel Penny stuff?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, yeah. Not the brightest bulb on the Christmas tree, that one. Definitely not. Now, going on from that, as it pertains to media, etc. I wanted to touch on this because we missed it yesterday. Caitlin Clark, audio soundbite 22. She's doubled down. So Caitlin Clark came out and said that she felt like it was white privilege. That she was saying that she somehow was the beneficiary of white privilege. And she doubled down on it in this soundbite. Listen. I think we have it. Okay.
I always have had really good perspective on everything that's kind of happened in my life, whether that's been good, whether that's been bad. And then obviously coming to the WNBA, like I've said, I feel like I've earned every single thing that's happened to me over the course of my career. But also, I grew up a fan of this league from a very young age. Like, my favorite player was Maya Moore. Like, I know what this league was about. And like I said, like, it's only been around 25 plus years. So I know there's been so many amazing Black women that have been in this league, and continuing to uplift them, I think, is very important. And that's something I'm very aware of. And like I said, like, I try to just be real and authentic and, you know, share my truth. And I think that's very easy for me. Like, I'm very comfortable in my own skin. And that's kind of been how it is my entire life.
Yes.
Mm. So she says that she's admits feeling privilege as a white person and says that the WNBA was built on Black players. No, it wasn't. The WNBA was the welfare recipient of the NBA. Nobody gave a rat's ass about women's basketball. Women don't even give a rat's ass about women's basketball. The WNBA was subsidized by the NBA. It is the welfare recipient of the NBA. NBA players and NBA viewers and NBA game attendees built the WNBA. Let's not pretend like these women who are in the WNBA built it. They can barely keep what was given to them. And then when they get someone who gets the eyeballs, they trash her and drag her down because they are a bunch of jealous bitches. That's the reality of it. And then they want to play victimhood and act as though everything's a racial hustle when it's not. She is one. What is her privilege exactly? And I know a lot of people are slamming her. And I just think that she is navigating something that no one has ever had to go through before. And that's part of what my point. How in the hell does she have white privilege when she is like one of, she's a minority player in the WNBA? How in the hell does she have white privilege? They have been racist bitches to her since she got there. They have targeted her. They have smeared her. They have acted like she is less than. And to her credit, she's ignored it up until now. I mean, she's ignored it up until, you know, this point. So I don't know how she's considered privileged. She works hard and she has talent. But how is that a privilege? She works hard with her talent. I mean, this is, it's goofy. She gets athlete of the year and then she has to apologize. I feel as though she's, because she had said, quote, I want to say that I've earned every single thing, but as a white person, there is a privilege. I disagree with this. And she said a lot of those players in the league that have been really good have been Black players. This league has kind of been built on them, blah, 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 blah. Again, someone who is she's a minority player in the WNBA on her team, and she has to admit to some kind of privilege. They can't just credit her talent. Like Time Magazine, they said Clark is cognizant of the racial underpinnings of her stardom. She says, I want to say the quote that I gave you, but the fact that she says that, oh yes, the racial underpinnings, Time Magazine and writing about her, the racial underpinnings of her stardom. The racial underpinnings of the WNBA, nobody watches it. She just is like a beaten dog. But at the same time, she's never had to navigate, nobody's ever had to navigate anything like this in the WNBA or in anything like this. A female, this is kind of new. It's very new. But she's allowing herself to be bullied at this point. And there are players of a different race that did not generate the eyeballs that she generated. They did not generate the interest for the league that she generated. And they feel like they're trying to other her. They're trying to say that the only reason that she's talented is because of some sort of privilege. Being white doesn't make her play better. Practicing hard and working hard does. And she has a natural born talent that is entirely unrelated to her skin color. She just happens to be a white girl. But no one can credit her talent because no one wants to admit that she just might be a better player than Angel Reese, or she just might be a better player than some of the other women on the teams in WNBA. They can't say that. So they have to discredit her talent by saying, oh, well, white privilege. The hell does white privilege have to do with being naturally talented at basketball? I suck at basketball, love watching it. And I always wanted to play it, but I'm not very good, Kane. No. Where's my white privilege? I was told that I would have privilege. Look, as badly as I wanted to be on my school's basketball team, and I never made it, I was varsity everything I did but basketball for some reason. I have no idea why. Doesn't make sense. I did 18 years of classical ballet, and then I was varsity everything I did from freshman on. Basketball, could not do it. No idea why. Where's my white privilege for that? Right? I wanted it. Isn't that how it works? If you're white and you want it, don't you automatically get it? Kane, how does white privilege work? Isn't that how it works? You're only you're white adjacent though, 50%. Yeah. So I don't know.
Yeah, I get a 50% card.
Yeah,
50% privilege.
But the other 50% of you, what privileges have you gotten?
Gosh, I don't know.
You haven't gotten any privileges?
Not that I know of.
But wait a minute, I'm told that if you're white, you get all these special things.
Yeah, I don't. They only see the non-white half of me, apparently.
Does it? Did you? You played football, right?
Yeah.
Were you a better football player because you were white? Half white?
No. I don't
think so. It didn't give you any kind of like special superpower?
No.
I mean, I always thought that you played worse. Remember the Woody Harrelson movie, White Men Can't Jump? That was huge when I was a kid. And I remember looking at that title thinking, I wonder if they can't. Yeah. Hollywood. Just saying.
It's true.
Do you feel bad for her? Caitlin Clark?
Do I feel bad for what she's had to go through and all of that?
Do you feel like she's like been browbeaten into this?
I think so. I think so. She literally just wants to play basketball. She just wants to get along with everybody. She just wants to have fun. And everyone else is thrusting her in these directions and making her do these things. It just doesn't seem, just like anybody who doesn't do anything that comes naturally to them, it doesn't look right and it doesn't feel right.
Lorraine says that she feels like she's saying this to make the other girls on the team feel better.
Probably, because she wants to get along with them. She wants
How
to
lame
have...
are the chicks in this league?
Well, what
if
was the...
If you have to have this woman like lie prostrate in front of the media to make you feel better, I'm going to say something mean. Should I say... I've already said it once, but these women are... They are.
I read lips. I didn't know I was a lip reader till just now.
It's that white privilege. You would have been able to hear the voice in your head had you been full. I'm just saying, that's how it works, right? Lorraine says that she's always lifted up her teammates, always been very humble. She always seems like she's tried to ignore this. But that's sort of, notice, and this is how it is, and it doesn't matter if it's Caitlin Clark or whoever. This is why I'm like, never been in need of the rage mob, because they don't care. She's never going to be forgiven. She is the original sin of being born white. I mean, that's how all of her critics and all these people around WNBA are acting like. Maybe if you bitches could play basketball a little bit better, then maybe she wouldn't be getting all the attention. Maybe if y'all were half as talented as she was, then maybe, oh, I don't know, maybe you would get more advertising dollars. Maybe you would get more sponsorships yourself. Instead of hating on her, all you women need to be thanking her for keeping eyes on the WNBA, which has been nothing more than a glorified welfare recipient of the NBA. And you all know it's true, bitches. You know it's true. Yeah. I'm so tired of this stuff. They're a bunch of bullies. Grown middle-aged women being bullies. Women who are in their 30s being bullies. At some point, you need to grow up. You do. People are going to be like, Dana, I don't like your language. I am not Dora the Explorer, okay? You're not sitting in church, and this ain't PBS. I do feel bad for her because she's never had to navigate this. And I think that people who are trying to jump all over her need to slow their roll a little bit. I think the people who need most of the ire are the coaches and the league and her teammates. Those are the people that you need to be sharp with. Because I think she's just trying to navigate and deal with it. And she didn't come out and she seemed very hesitant when she was saying the stuff that she said. But if she thinks, though, that this kind of thing is going to make it to where they accept her and they celebrate her and they stop giving her grief, no. In fact, it's going to double. Because if they see you bleed, then they're going to come for more. That's how it works.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of the United States.
So I hope that you all feel that sense of, you know, peace and light, and that just for a moment when you leave here today that you feel, I don't know, a sense of joy. Because I think we all need like this, you know, we all need to feel joy now during this time of the season, during this time. So anyway, okay, now I'll start. You're all reading into that.
So they were saying, oh, you sound like Kamala. And she's like, you all are reading into it. She sounded exasperated there. I was on with Jesse Waters earlier this week, and he asked me, it was kind of an aside, but he had brought up how Joe isn't like really looking at Kamala when they go and they do these events. Like, he's not looking at her, and they don't have any kind of interaction, anything like that. And he had said, how did he ask me? Something to the effect of, well, is it overblown because, you know, Joe is old? And I said, well, no, because look at Jill. So their dynamic is, especially right now, and it used to not always be like this, when they were first married, and even during, I mean, 10 years ago, he was really aggressive and a jackwagon. And now she's the aggressive one because he's, you know, declining. And so she sets the tone. So you can watch them. Their dynamic is she sets the tone. And if you want to know where they stand on someone, watch how she acts. She's the wife. And if the wife doesn't like someone, if they don't like anybody, you're going to know. You're going to know. And she makes it known. How many different videos have there been? I've seen at least 5. Two of them were at the same event. But where Kamala Harris was like looking at her and smiling, and Jill Biden just does not even acknowledge her. After he's out of office, after Trump is in office, I think you're going to hear about some stuff. And I think it's going to get real petty. I really do. Stick with us. We have a whole other hour on the way next.
You're really basic.
I'm going to phrase it slightly differently, and you guys can tell me if I'm completely wrong in saying it this way. You know, later in the night, we're also going to talk about Penny and the verdict there. Mm-hmm. There you also have a victim who somebody determined did not deserve to continue living, right?
No.
Yeah, tell me.
No,
tell me which, vigilante action is okay.
What do you mean vigilante action? So someone's not allowed to defend themselves? So, no, it was Jordan Neely who decided that Daniel Penny and everyone else on that in the subway at the time, that they could not just exist peacefully. He was in their faces threatening them. Why do these people assist in the violence of these absolute thugs? So I don't know who this broad is on CNN, and I don't care to learn her name because her opinions are so stupid. She's not going to last long in this industry. So it doesn't matter that we know her name or even note the spelling of it. She's just another stupid opinion that is, you know, platformed by CNN. That being said, the idea that something was done to him as opposed to he was doing things to other people that they did not deserve, that made them feel unsafe and was frankly dangerous. And so they were defended. Why do people omit that? I find that disgusting. You're a racist if you're omitting that. When I hear people talk about this story, the first thing I do is when I hear that they completely omit Jordan Neely's criminal actions, his violent record, the fact that he was, you know, threatening to kill people, including mothers and children on that in the subway platform. I can't take those people seriously anymore. There's not a conversation worth happening. Those people think that women can get raped and get assaulted and their children can get kidnapped and everything else, and that none of those people can do anything to stop it, because if they do, they're infringing on the right of the criminal to take advantage of them. That's what this is. I guess, you know, some of these progressives think that if, depending on what your skin color is, you have a right to hurt other people. That's the God's honest truth of it. That's fact. They honestly believe this. They think that they in order to settle the score, some people got to be hurt. So they believe. I'd say, you know, prove me wrong, but you'd waste your time because there's no, I'm right. It's the truth of it. I just can't believe that, you know, oh, he wasn't a victim. He was victimizing other people, but he wasn't a victim. That's like blaming, you know, well, your skirt's too short or something like that. It's just asinine. The hell is wrong with these people? What the hell is wrong with some of these people on the left? Seriously. I don't want to ever hear those people complain if they are put in a position where they have to defend themselves. Because they're trying to criminalize defense and say that depending on the person's ethnicity, you can't defend yourself because that's racist. Now, defending yourself from attack is racist. If you're a woman trying to shield your baby in a stroller from a guy screaming that he's going to kill you, it's racist if you defend yourself or if someone else defends you. Why don't you try that with your family? I dare say none of these people who take that position would like it if they found themselves a victim of Jordan Neely. And apparently there were a lot of them. 42 arrests in 8 years. He battered old people. He broke bones and faces of elderly people. He tried to kill a woman by shoving her on the subway tracks. He tried to kidnap a 7-year-old. Oh, these were arrests. Absolutely. There's a record for him. His family was nowhere to be found until they smelled money. It's just some of the, just a horrible, horrible take from these people. And then you have, we were talking about, we played this last hour, Audio Soundbite 7, but Taylor Lorenz, when she was, Taylor Lorenz, she's like some 50-year-old who pretended that she was 30. So it seemed less ridiculous if she wrote about Taylor Swift. And she got fired from Vox or something like that. I don't know what her appeal is other than she's a good avatar for the stupidity on the left. And it makes for, you know, content that you can work around. But there were enough people on the left that said that they enjoyed or that they celebrated or that they felt joy over watching the CEO be gunned down in the middle of the street. Listen to this. Audio Summit 7.
I think that's why I felt, along with so many other Americans, joy, unfortunately, you know, because it feels like...
Seriously?
I mean...
Joy in a man's execution?
Maybe not joy, but certainly not empathy. Because again...
We're watching the footage. How can this make you joyful? This guy's a husband, he's a father, and he's being gunned down in the middle of Manhattan. Why does that make you joyful?
Of Americans that be murdered. So are the tens of thousands of Americans, innocent Americans, who died because greedy health insurance executives like this one push a policies of denying care.
She's like somebody who read one essay about health insurance in college, and now she thinks she's an expert. What is she even talking about? So because she doesn't like the way in health insurance works, and by the way, health insurance is that way because you stupid morons, the Taylor Lorenzes of the world, make it that way. We could have it be portable. We could have it to where you could make insurance companies compete and you could purchase across state lines, et cetera, et cetera, carry it with you wherever. But you know who fought against that? Democrats did. Democrats fought against it. They were the ones who barred that. That was Republicans that were trying to make that happen before Obamacare was passed. They had like 13 other proposals. For all the people who get out there and say Republicans had no proposals to Obamacare, those people who say that aren't educated enough to be included in this big kid conversation. The people who say that didn't pay attention enough to their own government. And so they need to stay out of this conversation and let people who do know what happened actually continue on the merits of fact. Because there were 13 alternatives to Obamacare, and every single one of them were shot down by Democrats who controlled everything. And numerous proposals included the portability, you know, keeping it untethered from your work. It's asinine that your job has to provide you with your health insurance. It's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. You should be able to get it for yourself. It should be affordable. And you should be able to use it like you do car insurance or something. The other reason is people use insurance wrong. That drives up the cost too. The dumb Taylor Lorenzes of the world. 50 years old and you act like a 15-year-old bimbo. I don't get it. Like, what the hell's wrong with you? Like, Arrested Development, that one. Oh, I don't feel bad. Make sure you quote me accurately, Media Matters. And then please make note that I don't have enough middle fingers to give you salutes. You George Soros lotion boys. Anyway. It's true. Let's be real. This joy that you feel, you created the situation. He's just running one of the companies, and you created the regulations in which he has to operate. You created the framework. He has to operate in that framework. Why are they mad? They're mad because of what they created? They're mad because they don't like the conditions of insurance? They're mad because they made it a hellscape? Just so dumb. And Obamacare's trash. It absolutely is trash. But that's what, you know, and the other difference, and Kane noted this, to even compare the healthcare CEO to Jordan Neely is one of the dumbest things I've ever seen. The CEO had no idea what was happening. He was walking in a different direction, and this cowardly trust fund socialist came up behind him and shot him. Jordan Neely was threatening to murder people in their faces after he's already tried to murder people. So this is just so goofy. But they feel joy. They feel joy. I bet she would have felt joy. I bet if they watched, if there had been footage of Jordan Neely threatening to kill people and getting in the faces of these women, scaring the babies that were on the subway train, on the subway car. I bet that the Taylor Lorenzes of the world would have felt joy at that too, wouldn't they have? Because they're psychos. Would they have felt joy watching a mother try to shield her child as Jordan Neely was screaming about how he was going to kill them all? Does that get them off? It makes me wonder. These people are that messed up. How messed up are you that you actually have that enthusiasm over that kind of stuff? These people have a screw loose. And I'm not talking about the Jordan Neelys. I'm talking about like the CNN lady and this bra that we just played on Piers Morgan's whatever. What the hell is the matter with you? You soulless cretins. Y'all need Jesus and a Bible for Christmas. That's what y'all need. Good night. It actually makes me enraged. It makes me enraged. Meanwhile, Daniel Penny and his lawyers were interviewed by the New York Post audio Sunbite 5. They were celebrating his not guilty verdict. And you know what? It was weird because I was watching all the video footage of this where they were, I guess they stopped by at a bar and had a celebratory pint. And he still is very, and I'm going to use the word correctly, Gen Z, demure. And he's just very polite and he doesn't really talk a lot. And he says hi. And then he walks away and his lawyer talks for, you know, and most of the stuff that I've seen. Watch this. This is audio Sunbite 5.
How you feeling?
Good.
Yeah.
He's feeling good. He's feeling good. He's feeling good.
What's up?
Come together. How's it going? How's it feel?
Feels great. He's finally got the justice he's deserved.
Did you think it was going to happen?
Sorry?
And he walks in. Good for him.
No, we think that this should have happened probably on day one. But
he seems like a very reluctant hero, too. And, you know, you had those BLM people who were screaming about him not being safe in the city. You know, one of the things that people don't remember is that when you the jury was made up of predominantly women. And it was black and white. And every single one of the jurors voted to acquit him. So all the people who weren't there in that courtroom and the people who weren't there around for Neely this entire time, maybe they should, you know, shut up about that because these people were. They saw everything. And good for him. He just kind of, I don't think that you're going to see him. I know he's talking to Jeanine Pirro, but I don't think you're going to like see or hear him. I don't think he's going to pop up like on the lecture circuit or anything like that. He seems like a very reluctant kind of hero, doesn't he? And, not at all how the left needs him to be in order to make their narratives work. Shame on them.
And now, all of the news you would probably miss. It's time for Dana's Quick Five.
So The Guardian, which is a left-leaning POS over in Britain, says that the college enrollment rate is falling at a concerning, or the college enrollment levels dropping at a concerning rate. Fewer 18-year-olds are enrolling, especially at four-year schools, but the number of applications continues to grow. I think there needs to be a reworking of the college system entirely. I think it's absolutely stupid. It's a racket. I think that they try to charge you thousands of dollars to take stupid, idiotic humanities classes that do nothing to enrich one's mind, further one's education, or have anything to do with their major at all whatsoever. And I think that if any college receives any kind of federal money and they require these students to take these stupid courses as part of their, their degree coursework, they should be penalized. Personally, I mean, honestly, it's really is stupid. The way we run higher education is one of the dumbest aspects of this country. It really is. And thanks, left. Thanks for doing that. Thanks for consolidating all of the tuition and the loans and driving up costs for everybody. Tokyo adopts a 4-day work week because they're desperate that women have more kids. They do have a huge issue over there as it relates to population size. Their population growth is been super slow. They said their fertility rate plummeted to a record low of 1.2 in 2023. Super low fertility rate. So they're implementing a 4-day work week for their employees beginning next year, offering them 3-day weekends and family-friendly options. And they said that they have to do it to support families. Also, you know, it's a cultural thing and an economic thing. If you could have more families live comfortably on one income, you would probably see more. If you had lower taxation and less government spending, you would probably see more able to make that choice. And I think that not just here in the United States, but I think that that goes for any country, anybody, because this is something that's affecting everybody around the world. Here they go. Here they're setting up the narrative. Telegraph, another left-leaning POS in Britain. America's economy risks massive Trump slump. They're setting Trump up to... I told you this was going to happen. We both told you. Kane and I told you. We talked about this, Kane, for weeks. They're going to do this. They said... Here's the first sentence. Donald Trump risks tipping the U.S. into recession if he follows through with the promises made on the campaign trail. So if Republicans... Here's why Doge is going to have... and we'll talk more about this. Here's why Doge is going to have its work cut out for them. If they were to suggest all of these cuts to Congress, Congress still has to vote to implement them. That's number one. Number two, you see these headlines, that's just the start of it. If you have Republicans actually commit to austerity and reduce government spending and lower taxes, they are going to hammer the GOP with headlines like these. Absolutely. They're going to hammer them with these headlines because, and look what happened in Greece when they just tried to implement austerity. People were rioting in the streets. So just saying, that's something to think about. This study says regularly posting on social media may worsen mental health in adults. Oh, I completely agree that. I completely agree with that. In fact, there's most adults, I think, on social media, not us, but everybody else. I think that they live up to this headline hype. Stick with us. Welcome back to the program. Dana Lash here with you at the bottom of the second hour. And of course, you can watch us coast to coast. You can listen terrestrially. You can check us out, Channel 347 DirecTV. Also on X, Rumble, where the chat happens. YouTube, not so much. So we're everywhere. We're all over the place. Every state. So one of the things we were talking about, first segment of this hour, right? Yeah. Earlier was this Time Magazine cover of POTUS Elect. And how it seemed to be to me this reluctant sort of acceptance of the inevitable, that because it was an oddly somewhat respectable cover that they gave to a Republican. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, don't get excited, though. Everybody wants to. Don't get excited about that because it's the trash media. I mean, they're a bunch of jackwagons. It's the trash media. And I was thinking about this in context of right media, left media, how we got to this point. And I read this really good piece the other day from a friend of mine, Mark Judge. We're going to have him on in a minute. But it's called The Coming Conservative Media Collapse. And I thought, ooh, that's a very intentionally provocative title. Let's dive into this. And he's right. He gets into the conservative media structure, which definitely now has a formula, and how they've got to find something else to kind of to focus on. They need to get back to art and culture and all of these other issues because people are tired of politics. I mean, even all of you out there in radio land, one of the things that we know when we go and survey all of our hundreds of affiliates across the country, people get tired of it. They get tired of politics. So you got to shift. But that is not what, that's not the incentive on which conservative media is built on. Not right now, not anymore. So what are we going to do? My friend Mark Judge joins me, and he is an author and also became famous during the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearing. I almost said trial because it was like a trial where they were trying to assassinate him in the court of public opinion. And they dragged all of Brett Kavanaugh's friends in it. Every friend that the man ever had, they dragged through the mud, including Mark Judge, who joins me now on Skype. Mark, it's so good to be with you. There's a couple of things that I want to talk with you about, but starting with this, you are, I think, spot on with your observance of the new conservative media structure. And I would even go so far as to say there's even less investigative work because we're so used to playing defensively that I think we forgot how to do almost anything else. I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you remember when we were younger in like the 1980s, Dana, there was a whole infrastructure in a community that used to support and bolster and hold up and coming artists in bands, in the fine arts and movies, you know, Martin Scorsese.
Oh, yeah.
There were little rock clubs like the 930 Club in D.C. where I lived, where you go to see bands like R.E.M. who are up and coming. And the point is there was support for these artists. And even though they were on a smaller scale back then, and I don't think conservatism has made similar investments. And post-election, we find ourselves with people sick of politics and saying, hey, I think I'm going to go see a movie. Who are the cool new bands now? I think I'll go to a jazz club. And that ecosystem is still largely controlled by the left. And I can give specific examples of projects that, if funded for a small amount, would really get a lot of bang. But we just haven't worked that muscle. And I should add, you know, I'm not really blaming too much because conservatives were defending against communism and socialism and wokeness. So that was a full-time job. But we really need to start putting our money in culture more because I think, as Andrew Breitbart knew, that has a much longer-term effect.
Oh, I completely agree. And that's one of the things that the right has always been kind of bad at. They do tons of white papers and think tanks and all this other stuff. Nobody cares about that. Nobody cares about those things anymore. It shifts. I wanted to just share this graph this paragraph that you wrote in your piece. It's over at Chronicles Magazine. You wrote, yet what to do when the dog catches the car? Because you're talking about all of the conservative outlets that have covered all of this stuff. And this was good effort and it was for a good mission. You write, yet what to do when the dog catches the car? The second era of Trump has ushered in new times. As actress and fellow Gen Xer Justine Bateman has noted, it's like a fog has lifted. Artists feel a sense of freedom that's escaped them for years. You noted a few years ago, the music critic for Washington Post, Chris Richards, announced that white bands should not cover songs by black artists. That sentiment now seems preposterous. It's like some of the rebel spirit of the 80s is back, something I think Bateman was sensing too. People are turning away from the screaming matches and back to culture. Even someone as conservative and interested in politics as I am can't watch any more shouting pundits on TV. It's over. So what's next?
Well, I'll give you a very specific example. After the Kavanaugh nightmare, I wrote a book called The Devil's Triangle. You graciously gave me a blurb. I was radioactive at that time, and you said you'd give me a blurb, so I appreciate you so much for that. And as egocentric as it might sound, let me just quickly say, this is a tremendous book about this nightmare I lived.
It's a great book.
And right after all this happened, I got contacted by a Hollywood actor, a well-known actor, I will not say his name, and he said, well, how many offers have there been to turn this into a film? And I said, none. And he literally went, oh. And he said, you know, here we have a psychological thriller. This is not a black and white conservative come to Jesus story. It's a story about a flawed protagonist who comes up against the American Stasi, and there is evil. And he said, this is all the president's men, or the parallax view with the little Caddyshack thrown in. And he said, had you lied about your friend and thrown him under the bus, there wouldn't be one movie made about you. There'd be three.
Yeah.
And so for the past 6 months, we've produced a treatment. We have a treatment of a film based on this book. And again, I don't mean to sound like it's about me because it's not. It's about the other people involved. And we have people in Hollywood reading this thing saying, okay, the election's over. this could be a great film, not a satirical film, not a very broad Christian film, although I'm a Christian, I love those kind of films. This could be a Taxi Driver or, you know, a film like that. And the actor said to me, $10 million, two nights on Netflix. He's been in movies with Johnny Depp. He knows what he's talking about. So we're sitting here thinking, okay, the election's over. This treatment is floating around Hollywood. The budget is loose change for Netflix, and it's a great story. Why won't someone make this movie? And I think I'm one of many, many people with similar stories.
Do you think it's because Hollywood is terrified? They don't know. I think for two reasons. They're worried about the backlash from the far left. That's sort of their base. But also, they are so unfamiliar with not just so much conservatism, but that individualist like ethos that they don't even know how to approach the material.
They don't. And I'll quickly tell you, they're terrified of the material because since my book came out, I've written several articles about this in Chronicles and the Washington Examiner and elsewhere. Dana, Marty Baron, former editor of the Washington Post, wrote a memoir talking about me. NPR interviewed Christine Blasey Ford on air and reviewed her book. And I'm on social media calling these cowards out and saying, why won't you give me equal time? Mm. Why, you're a journalist who edited the Washington Post for 20 years. You talk about me in your book. I point to the mistakes you made, and you're too much of a coward to respond to me. So my point being is that if they're afraid, then Hollywood's really going to be afraid because they don't want to open this thing and say, oh, Christine Blasey Ford and these other people were extorting Mark Judge, using honey traps and witness tampering, and he reveals all this in his book, The Devil's Triangle. There ain't no way we can make a movie about that. There's no way. And even if I said, you know, be sympathetic to people. I don't want to villainize anybody other than the politicians and the media. The kids I went to school with in the 80s, I don't want them demonized. But they are too chicken-ass to face me on social media, much less in Hollywood. They're cowards. That's what it is.
Yeah, I completely. We're talking with our friend Mark Judge, author of Devil's Triangle. And also he was dragged through the mud and unwillingly made infamous during the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. You, in this piece, and I'm going to switch to the Hegseth stuff here in a moment, but I think you just really hit the nail on the head in a very classy way because you say that conservatives are still badly outgunned by the left. I get the sense, and I was talking with a friend of mine who is like an associate editor at one of these conservative websites, and they were saying, oh, no, conservatives are really doing well, you know, with X, and now Elon Musk at X, and, you know, we're really balancing it all out. And I'm like, in what way? Like, maybe in the news, but where in the culture are you balancing it out? And you touch on that. You said that the donor class never had any desire to put resources to work so we could compete in that manner. And that you said that, you know, it's not just, you know, being snarky Twitter gorillas and all of this stuff and focusing on stuff that Alec Baldwin says, but to penetrate the entertainment industry with deeper and more in-depth coverage and to create our own stuff. Is there anyone out there beside yourself that you think is really that needs, you know, attention or that you could point to and say like this or like this or like this? I feel like we have so few.
100%. A friend of mine named Paul Rowland, he is a writer for a conservative website. This is a perfect example. He made a movie called Exemplum. It's a black and white film about a priest who breaks bad. It's like Breaking Bad with a priest. And I'm Catholic. It's an awesome movie. I came across this thing last year. It's a great movie. Dana, the budget was $10,000.
How does this movie get made for $10,000? That's crazy.
It's called Exemplum. You can watch it for free. And this is a perfect example. And I contacted this guy and I said, and he writes for a conservative website. He's Catholic. Yeah. I said, why aren't conservatives propping you up and throwing money at you, dude? You wrote, produced, directed, and acted in this great movie. And he said, Mark, I'm getting nothing. So I wrote about him. I interviewed him several times. I reviewed his movie, and my review was out there on social media and everything. And to this day, he and I talk, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I keep saying, why aren't people throwing money at you, dude? You made this, you know, it cost $10,000 and his rating is 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
This guy is a gifted, young, conservative-leaning filmmaker who made this great film about a priest and morality and Solzhenitsyn and all this cool stuff, and he can't get arrested. So go to Exemplum and look him up. I don't have any stake in his movie, but he is the example I use.
You also have a piece talking with our friend Mark Judge over at Splice today. Pete Hegseth will be confirmed. This is a really great piece. And you get into what changed, what you think changed Joni Ernst's mind? Because she, I do disagree with some of the narrative out there that she was leading this campaign against him, but she definitely was not on board. She was very hesitant, I think, even to kind of like delve into it publicly. Tell me about this, because you have a theory.
I have a theory. It's just a hunch. I'm a good journalist, so I don't want to speculate too much. But Joni Ernst changed on a dime. She abruptly began to support Pete Hegseth. And long story short, I think Pete Hegseth, like myself during Kavanaugh, was getting extorted. And he might have been getting honey trapped, and he might have been getting threatened. And I think Joni Ernst found that out. I think she had a meeting with him and the FBI, because our situations are very similar. It's like I had people accusing me of drugging girls and gang rape, and I was getting served for crimes in states I've never been in. It was an absolute nightmare. And as I reveal in The Devil's Triangle, the whole thing was an extortionate plot. Now, Hegseth's alleged incident happened in 2017, which is right around the Kavanaugh thing. Mm-hmm. And my speculation is a survivor of sexual abuse like Joni Ernst, who's a tough, independent, strong woman, doesn't change on a dime because Trump threatened her. She's far too strong for that. That's like telling you what to do, Dan. It does not work. And so I'm thinking, well, what if she had a private meeting with Hegseth? Hegseth, who is saying, I look forward to the FBI investigation. I'm looking forward to that. What if she found out that he was being extorted? That would explain quite a lot, right? Because a sexual assault survivor doesn't just go, oh, they're calling me names, I'm going to support him now.
Right.
BS. I'm convinced she heard something. I'm convinced somebody said to her, hey, look, this was a scam. 2017, Mark Judge was getting honey trapped and getting extortionate calls. Is it possible they were doing it to him also? Yes, I think it is.
I think he will ultimately, depending on if this process goes through, because there's been so much palace intrigue, I think most of these individuals are going to be confirmed in the Senate. We got to have you back to talk more about it. We're running out of time right now, but our friend Mark Judge, and you can follow him on X at Mark G Judge as well. Get his book, Devil's Triangle, and you can go and read his pieces as well. It's all linked up on, we'll have it linked as well. Mark, it's so good to see you. We got to have you back again.
Danny, you gave me the blurb when I was radioactive, man. I love you. I will never forget that. So
you know what? I think the country owes you a lot of gratitude because you held strong and showed what it was like to be resolute in the fire. So you really gave a good example to a lot of people for them to follow. So I appreciate
it. It's an American Stasi, and they can get bent for all I care.
Gosh, it's the most Gen X thing so far that's been said today. God love you. Merry Christmas to you, my friend. Thank you. Good
Merry
to see
Christmas.
You.
Thanks, Dana.
It's his life mission to make bad decisions. It's time for Florida Man.
So a Florida man has threatened to light a homeowner's car on fire with a Molotov cocktail, said police in Cape Coral. A man was arrested over the weekend. Police said that he pulled out again with the swords. He pulled out a sword. Okay, stop, stop, stop. Full stop. Is that a thing in Florida? Every month, I have 2 to 3 stories. They're brand new, different from each other, different parts of Florida, where someone has a sword or a machete. Floridians, what is up? Do you all just like have swords? Is that a thing? What in the world? So this guy had a sword and a Molotov cocktail, and he wanted to make a point during an argument with a Cape Coral resident. Cape Coral police said that they got reports of a disturbance at the victim's home. They met with the homeowner. A 36-year-old man, he showed up in a driveway holding a glass bottle with a cloth wrapped around the top. He threatened to throw it, which he claimed was a Molotov cocktail, at one of the vehicles in the driveway and lighted on fire. He also had a sword, and he used the sword to tap on the windshield of a vehicle during the exchange. It was all captured on video by Ring doorbell, the camera. And the police located the guy. They asked him. He said, no, I went to go ask about the disrespect to a family member. And then he was arrested, taken to Lee County Jail, charged with violating the law that they have about manufacturing firebombs. Okay, there you go. But the sword, though. And was it actually a Molotov cocktail? They never really said. They never really confirmed that it was. But, you know. Let's see. This Florida man. Yeah, let's go ahead and do this. So, apparently, I don't think this guy was supposed to be gator hunting, and he was. And it was a company that showed that this guy and his friends, they went down to hunt some gators. And but the guy's wife apparently did not know. And there's videos, but there's a lot of cussing in them. But the guy apparently was, his wife didn't know that they were all having a little boys trip and they were all drinking and hunting gators, and then a gator bit his hand. So he's probably going to have to come up with a story as to how to tell his wife. It was done by Salty Adventures. And this Isaiah Trujillo and his friends, they were hunting gators, and then he got his hand bit. And apparently he told his wife he was worried more about his wife finding out. And he had said in the video, don't wake Katie up, whatever you guys do. He didn't bite that hard, like trying to hide it because he didn't want his wife to know he was out drinking and gator hunting. Why? She probably would want to come. Stay with us. Third hour next. You know what I was thinking about? First off, welcome. Dana Lash here, your retired goth curmudgeon. Good to be with you. We're at the top of our third hour. We have Border Thanos, Tom Homan, coming up at the bottom of the hour. Yeah. I was thinking, for the people who are super big mad over all the picks, I want you to ask yourself, but have they stole women's luggage? Have they stolen a lady's suitcase yet? Just saying. I mean, or can we just look for, I know that there are like, and look, I understand the objections to RFK Jr. at HHS and others, but who's that deputy HHS dude? Oh, Rachel. Yeah, there's like a Steven Tyler, there's like an Aerosmith song about him. You know the one. I mean, just compare. Yes.
The dude looks like a lady.
Song. Man looks like a ma'am.
Yeah. Lady. That's stretch too.
Kind of, you know. But did they steal ladies' luggage though? Mm. That's the question. Like that's, what is his name? Sam Brenton. That's right. The guy who legit stole women's luggage everywhere.
Multiple times.
And one of them was a black fashion designer from South Africa. And he stole her stuff and was wearing it all over. I mean, it was like very colorful, unique, one-of-a-kind pieces. And he was wearing it all over. He was in charge of like what, like nuclear stuff. Nuclear waste. How did he even get... First off, I just don't understand how you could be that damn crazy and then also find time to study nuclear waste. Because it seems like being that crazy is a full-time job. Right? Oh, you're going to wear PVC head to toe and go to fetish nights? But yet get up at 6 a.m. and go and do your nuclear waste job? Seems a little odd. You're going to steal ladies' luggage all over? By the way, another thing. You really have to be demented to do that, to steal someone's luggage at an airport. Think of all the people that are there. You don't know if the person who is waiting for their luggage is there watching you take their suitcase or not. Because then what if you're caught? That's theft. You're going to get in trouble immediately. Oh my gosh. And if you're with the government and you have like a clearance, a security clearance, you're going to get even more trouble. Just think about all of the mental gymnastics he had to go through in order to be like, I don't GAF and do it anyway. Right? That's just a whole other level.
It's Friday.
It is Friday. That's right. I mean... Does your HHS, do they look like, is it a dude that looks like a lady? Does your nuclear waste head steal ladies' luggage? I don't know. I'm just wondering. I got questions. We'd like to have them answered, right? I feel like that's the litmus right there. Have you ever, oh man, put me in charge. Oh my gosh. I would only run for elected office just to be able to sit in on a confirmation hearing and troll people with questions one time, and then I would resign my seat because then I don't want to do any of the other work. I don't care. I don't want to cooperate with these people. I hate everybody there. But just when was the last time you stole women's luggage? Oh, never. Right. When's the last time you dressed up entirely head to toe in PVC or as a furry and had puppy piles? Wink, wink. When did that happen? You know what I mean? Kane is dying right now. But you know it's true.
It reminds me of Easter at the White House.
Easter at the White House. That's right. Is that not like an OnlyFans thing? I'm surprised no one's done it. Really surprised. They probably did. Oh my gosh. One of the other things that is the cutting of all of the government excess as well. And they're saying that it's crazy, that it's not something that is realistic. I wanted to share with you this. I'm going to do it real quick. I'll make sure I link it in your prep on Monday. But I retweeted it, and it's an oldie but a goodie. I remember reading about this in college, and Rand Paul reminded me of the story about Davy Crockett, the original, you know, hardcore badass, right? And he was sharing this story about government appropriation. And it's it was published in 1867 in Harper's Magazine, and it was in the House, and it was a day where they were talking about appropriations, and everyone was suggesting they need to appropriate money for the benefit of this widow of a very distinguished naval officer. And people were getting up and they were making these beautiful, superfluous speeches, and they were very moving. And then they were about to put it to question, the House Speaker was, and then Davy Crockett stood up. And he was saying that as much respect as he had for the deceased, he was asking, and as much sympathy for the sufferings of the living, he had said that we must not permit our respect for the dead or our sympathy for a part of the living to lead us in to an act of injustice to balance the living. He said that Congress had no right to appropriate that money as charity. And he noted that the deceased lived a very long life after the close of war. In fact, the deceased was in elected office till the day of his death. And Crockett noted, I was not aware that the government was in any way in debt to him. And he said, because it's not a debt. Charity is not a debt. And he says, we do not have the authority to appropriate this public money as debt and give it as such. And he said, I'm the poorest man on this floor. I cannot vote for this bill. And he goes, well, I'll give 1 week's pay to the object if every member of Congress will do the same, and it will amount to more than the bill asks for. And they took a seat. Nobody replied. Nobody stood up and offered their own money also. And the bill did not pass unanimously as it was expected to do. Instead, it just spittered out on the floor and that was it. And he was asked why he did that, because originally people thought, well, that's rather cold of you, Davy Crockett. But he said, no, no, no. He said, several years ago, I was standing on the steps of the Capitol, and he said there were other members of Congress there, and there was a fire over in Georgetown. It was a very large fire, and we went over to help. Many houses burned, and there were families that were made homeless. And he said a bill was introduced appropriated, and this was a lot of money for that time, $20,000 for the relief. He said, we set all business aside, and we rushed it through. And he said, the next summer, when I was thinking about the election, I was going to go and scout around some of the people of my district. And he said, you know, I want to go and talk to some of the voters. And he said, and I found there was a farmer that he found plowing a field, and he came up to him and started talking to him. And the farmer basically told him to go pound sand. He was not interested in voting for Davy Crockett because he said Davy Crockett was stupid and didn't understand the Constitution. And this shocked Davy Crockett. Davy Crockett got an earful from this farmer who was like, I do not have time for you, sir. He said, you're an anti-constitutionalist. And Davy Crockett was like, what do you mean? And he said, I have voted against, and he was given the list of things. And the farmer goes, you remember the fire from Georgetown? When you rushed to appropriate $20,000 to spend. And he said, that government is not charity. It's not yours to give. He said, people could have donated. A lot of your fellow representatives could have written checks, and they would not have had to live one day out of the luxury to which they have grown accustomed. But they didn't do it. He said, everyone in the Senate could have done it, and they didn't do it. You sought to do it with the people's money instead and call it charity. The farmer told him, he said, it's not the amount, Colonel, I complain of. It's the principle. And the government ought to have in the treasury no more than enough for its legitimate purposes. And he goes, the power of collecting and dispersing money at pleasure is the most dangerous power that can be entrusted to man, particularly under our system of collecting revenue by tariff, because it reaches every man in the country, no matter how poor he may be. And he said, whether it was $20,000 or $200,000, it's not yours to give. And he humbled Davy Crockett that day. He humbled him. And he said, so, see, Colonel, you violated the Constitution. He said, because once you begin to stretch your power beyond the limits of the Constitution, and there is no limit, there is no security for the people. He goes, I don't doubt that you tried to act honestly, but that doesn't make what you did better. And so now you see that's why I cannot vote for you. And Davy Crockett was almost speechless. And he was very humble and very honest and transparent in his response. And he said, I stand corrected. You are right. He said, I thought I had the sense to understand the Constitution, and it is clear by what you just told me, I do not. You never hear a lawmaker say that, do you? You never hear a lawmaker say I was wrong and you corrected me. They always, because now there is no admittance of error because it is taken as a weakness instead of as a sign of strength to be able to recognize and build off of a mistake. And he says, he apologized to him. And he said, what you have said here at your plow has got more hard sound sense in it than all of the fine speeches I have ever heard. And he said, if I had ever taken the view of it that you have, I would have put my head into the fire before I would have given that vote. And he promised him. And he said, I ask for your forgiveness. And if you will forgive me and vote for me again, if I ever vote for an unconstitutional law, I wish that I may be shot, is what he said. He ended up being friends with that farmer, and the farmer did support him and ended up did getting influence for him. And Davy Crockett was true to his word and was consistent. But it's not easy to be a Davy Crockett. Everyone thinks it's Mr. Smith going to Washington, and it's not. It is not easy to be like Davy Crockett. It is not easy to be consistent. It is not easy to have principle because you are rewarded for your flexibility in D.C. You are rewarded for your move to do something temporary with immediate gain, immediate satisfaction. We are inventing a system where we reward the short term only to punish ourselves more harshly than we ever could have imagined in the long term. And that has to change. And I hope that it can change by cutting some of this government spending. But I am so used to being lied to and passed over and abused by my government that I don't think that any jury would convict me of an offense of not trusting them, or you for that matter. So we'll see. I hope that they can cut it. I hope, because nothing will ever happen until we cut government spending. The refineries that we need to produce more gas, we're not going to have it. Better oil, we're not going to have crude, have more crude, have more natural gas, we're not going to have it. The drilling to become once again net exporters of energy. We have to reduce spending in order to facilitate some of the things like this. And I agree, the Treasury should not have any more money than it absolutely needs for its legitimate purposes. That gets to my point. I always talk about Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. If we actually did keep it that way, we would be running a budget surplus. You wouldn't have the need for income tax. You wouldn't have the need for all of this extra spending. You wouldn't have the need for any of this. There have been countless analyses done by many an economic expert on this issue, and they all agree. If we had the courage to do it, if we had the discipline to withstand the austerity that comes with it, do we? Because this is more than just a test of a new Congress. It's more than just a test of a new Senate. It's more than just a test of a new cabinet. It is a test of the American electorate. It's not just these lawmakers that are being tested right now. It's you too. All of us. How will we do? We have more to come.
And now, all of the news you would probably miss. It's time for Dana's Quick Five.
This is a crazy story. So in Britain, their air traffic employees did a work from home day, and it exacerbated a nightmare of delays for 700,000 travelers. Yes, they were stranded. This was over a holiday weekend. The study's coming out now. Over last year, holiday weekend last year, they were wondering, why did we have all these technical glitches that stopped planes from taking off and landing, and it took hours to fix? Because engineers were working from home that day. No joke. They literally had to take some of them an hour and a half to get all the way from their houses to the airport and then take, you know, about 3 to 4 hours to fix the problem. And it, I mean, almost a million passengers were affected. That is crazy, crazy. Credit card debt hits a record $1.17 trillion, according to the New York Fed new research. Whoopi Goldberg claims a bakery refused to serve her because of her left-wing views. But as it turns out, she's smearing them. They said their boiler broke down. They had massive problems in their kitchen. They did not make her cupcakes because of who she is. It's a 145-year-old bakery, for crying out loud. This is ridiculous. And fears for alien safety. The government's firing high-pulse microwave weapons at UFOs now. Wait, there are things to fire at? Welcome back to the program. Dana Lash with you at the bottom of this third hour. And of course, you can listen coast to coast and you can watch the stream at Channel 347, DirecTV. We're also on X. The chat's at Rumble. And of course, don't forget YouTube and Facebook. One of the things that I think this was yesterday, the day before yesterday, we were talking about when the story hit was Israel closing its embassy in Ireland. And the shock that was from that, and we kind of dove into some of the history there between, you know, Ireland and Israel and World War II and some of this other stuff. And I've noticed an increase in questioning from people who don't seem to understand the mission or purpose of what the United States's alliance with Israel serves and how important it is to have an ally, you know, in the Middle East. And it just is kind of, it's wild to me that would even be questioned, but it is, which I think it's important that this book came out actually just this week. It's called The Battle for the Jewish State, How Israel and America Can Win. And it's authored by Victoria Coates, who also previously was the former deputy national security advisor to POTUS elect. Victoria Coates is vice president of Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at Heritage. And she joins us now via Skype. Victoria, congrats on the book. It was came out just this week, a couple of days ago. This is something, I mean, I don't know. I'm trying not to be naive, but am I wrong in noticing like an increase in questioning, I guess, as more people become politically aware or active and people are they're asking questions that I thought had obvious answers. You know, the United States' partnership with Israel, they're our only ally in this part of the world, and the importance of that relationship, which is what your book, examining it through October 7th, really gets to.
Well, Dana, great to be with you. And I think, you know, the reason I wrote The Battle for the Jewish State is precisely that. I think a lot of Americans do wonder, you know, what is the nature of the U.S.-Israel alliance? And I hate to date myself this way, but when I was born, the alliance was 20 years old. It's now 76 years old. So that is a historical arc that takes a sort of scrappy startup country to being one of the world's great powers. They're in the top 20 U.S. News and World Report list of most powerful countries. And so, you know, I think that does require a reexamination. I've heard all those questions that you've heard, and there are strong answers to them. And that's what you find in The Battle for the Jewish State is the history of the alliance, why the alliance matters, what the heck happened after October 7th? How did we find ourselves in this war too? Mm. And, you know, why it is a war on both Israel and the United States.
I think that's a great way to put it. We're talking with Victoria Coates on Skype, via Skype. And you mentioned October 7th, in which there were American hostages taken, which we don't really hear about a lot at all, really, from this administration. And in fact, I dare say that it like slipped down the issue of priorities for not just politicians, but maybe even the attention span of voters as we went into the election season. I mean, you have terrorists that are holding hostage Americans still. That's incredibly important. I mean, and especially from the same administration that flubbed Afghanistan, messed up, you know, the withdrawal in Afghanistan. Did this administration even have a response to that? I mean, I'm just shocked that we still have American hostages.
No, it is shocking and it's disgraceful. And President Biden really stopped talking about them after Christmas of 2023, when there were some deals to get some hostages out. Those were good photo ops for him. So he talked about them then. But then he stopped because they became an inconvenient truth for them, for the administration trying to elevate the Palestinians, trying to rehabilitate Hamas, trying to pressure Israel into a negotiated ceasefire with terrorists. But not only do we still have American hostages, four of whom we pray are still alive. But we lost more Americans on October 7th, Dana, than in any terrorist attack. It's the second most deadly terrorist attack after 9/11. And so it's a really dire situation for the United States. And furthermore, what we've seen since then are not pro-Israel demonstrations on our political, on our city streets or our academic campuses. We've seen pro-Hamas demonstrations. So this is here at home.
You also touch on how this is not just some simple regional squabble that you can send some diplomats to and they can have a peace negotiation. It's not going to get solved that way because it is, you know, it's like a holy war plus a cultural battle, you know, plus a military battle. And after, you know, Assad left, that regime's collapsing in Syria, Iran was really hit, really hit hard. And that really highlighted that Shia-Sunni fight in this part of the world and how you have like one faction that hates Israel really wants to establish itself as the powerhouse. And then you have these other factions who don't hate Israel. They're willing to work with them. We got the Abraham Accords. That really kind of is like the power struggle. And Israel's sort of in the way of this, like Russian, Iranian, Chinese dominance in the area. Is that like just like too myopic of a view of this? Because it seems like it all kind of boils down to that, at least partially.
Well, I don't think that's too myopic, but and I think it's a really important point. I was actually in Israel and then in Bahrain, an Abraham Accords country, as the fall of Syria was happening week before last. And it was really interesting because the Gulf countries, they only wanted to talk to the Israelis and find out what was going on and how to keep a lid on this situation, because those Sunni Gulf monarchies are deeply concerned about the radical Islamists who are part of the now governing body of Syria. So, yes, we're all delighted Assad is spending Christmas in Moscow. Hope it's nice and cold for him, and very cognizant of the many atrocities he committed against the Syrian people. But that doesn't make the Turkish-backed HTS folks angels. And so you have quite the alphabet soup of former ISIS and al-Qaeda alums in there. And the interesting thing is, as Israel claimed a little bit of territory in the Golan Heights adjacent to the space they already have, you had all sorts of people accusing them of being imperialist, that they were somehow trying to conquer the Levant. Well, news flash, nobody wants Syria. I mean, Syria doesn't want to be Syria. And so, you know, the notion that Israel wants to take that territory over, given just, you know, the intractable problems that country faces, is ridiculous on the face of it. And I think the cooperation between the Gulf and Israel is only strengthening, even after a year of war. And that's a great and good thing.
Yeah, very good thing indeed. We're talking with Victoria Coates, her new book, The Battle for the Jewish State, How Israel and America Can Win. I don't know of any other country that's worked as hard as Israel has at trying to maintain peace and be peaceful and only responding when it is incredibly important to do so in defense of national security or, you know, of life, of Israeli life. But yet that's not how it's processed. That's not how it's laundered in the media. They're always painted as the aggressor. And even the words from our own government, you know, have kind of, you know, hinted that, oh, well, they're aggressive here. We need to stop the bombing of Gaza, for instance, when, you know, really they've only ever responded once they've been shelled. Then they respond to protect themselves. Is that ever going to change? I mean, when does that stop? When does reality set in?
Well, I'm hopeful that it is. And the clarity that President Trump brings to this issue is being welcomed by every reasonable person in the region. And, you know, going back to the hostages for a minute, I also was in Israel when his Truth Social post came out about the hostages. This is something Joe Biden could have done 15 months ago. He could have said, let them out now, or there's going to be hell to pay. And he didn't for 15 months. President Trump is saying that there's movement now from Hamas. Concessions are being made to Israel, not the other way around. So we could see them out now during the season of Hanukkah, Christmas next week. That would be a great and good thing. But that would happen only because President Trump had the clarity that he did. So I'm hopeful that as, you know, we get closer to the inauguration and beyond, you know, that he makes good on what he's been saying, that he wants this war to end, but he wants it to end in an Israeli victory. And we're not going to have another ceasefire. We're not going to let Hamas regroup and rearm and attack again. We're going to end this vicious cycle of violence that's been going on for really 50 years. Mm-hmm. And the greatest victims are the Palestinian people.
And you mentioned, too, you know, just the way that, the current administration has responded to October 7th. I can't imagine if Israel had listened to the Biden administration and had not hit back at Hezbollah as hard as they did and sent them reeling. And I think really kind of started this, you know, domino effect that led to, you know, what we see with, you know, Assad now in Moscow. If they had not have hit back as hard, if they had not pushed back against Hezbollah, I mean, where would we be if they had listened to the Biden administration and not done anything?
We'd be back where we were in 2009 when Condi Rice, I mean, a Republican Secretary of State, abstained from a United Nations Security Council resolution condemning Israel for violence in Gaza. We'd be back where we were after the 2014 Gaza war when John Kerry withheld arms from Israel until they stopped fighting Hamas. After the 2021 Gaza war, you see where I'm going here. I mean, this is history repeating itself. And if, you know, after October 7th, I think Israel said, we cannot afford to have this kind of a risk on our border anymore. We have to take decisive action. And no thanks to the Biden-Harris administration, you know, they've been slogging through the trenches now for 15 months doing the Lord's work. And I think what they've achieved against Hamas, and importantly, as you noted, Hezbollah in the north, is going to be, in the long term, a huge good thing for the region and beyond. Mm. But as I said, no thanks to the United States in this case.
Victoria, put it in terms that people can, you know, really understand. When they look at our ally Israel, what happens with a compromised Israel? What happens if Israel were to weaken and we don't have that strong ally in that part of the world? Because obviously there's going to be a blowback to the U.S. if that were to ever happen. What does that look like?
Yeah, it really would be a kind of a deadly weakness for us. The Middle East, you can try to pivot away from it, but it won't pivot away from you. And the fact of the matter is, it is that crossroads between East and West. A lot of the world's shipping goes through that region, and a lot of the world's energy reserves are in that region. And so, especially as we take on our new stance as an energy superpower and grow into that strategically, you know, we want to have influence in that region where there are other significant reserves. Without Israel, we really don't have that point of power projection, and the collaboration between our countries on intelligence, on the development of weapon systems, notably missile defense. This is critical to the security of the American people. But then I'd just say, you know, you would have trouble using your iPhone, eating a cherry tomato, all sorts of things that they've achieved in the medical field without Israel. I mean, it is beyond security. They are the startup nation. They are, you know, an enormous tech hub and have become prosperous well beyond their size. And I think that is a great ally for the United States.
Yeah, definitely. This is a must-read book. I think that provides a lot of context that's normally missing from this conversation nationally and internationally. The book is The Battle for the Jewish State, How Israel and America Can Win. Victoria Coates, we'd love to have you back. Victoria, thank you so much for what you do. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Merry Christmas to you,
Merry
Chris.
Christmas.
Thanks.
Thank you. I want to know why Trump and Chip Roy are fighting now. Or actually, I just want to know why Trump is fighting Chip Roy. He is blasting him on Truth Social for some reason. I have no idea why. He had said that he tweeted out, quote, Chip Roy is just another ambitious guy with no talent. By the way, how's Bob Good doing? I hope some talented challengers are getting ready in the great state of Texas to go after Chip in the primary. He won't have a chance. Okay, first off, why in the hell is Trump speaking more harshly of Chip Roy than he ever has of Mike Johnson? Yeah. Chip Roy is a conservative stalwart who has delivered on Trump's agenda more than Mike Johnson could ever hope to. Go and look at the voting record. I'm not even playing. Go look at it. Bob Good was a conservative stalwart. People have to be strategic. Is it about uplifting your ego, or is it about securing the country for voters? I didn't vote for this. I didn't vote for people to sit here and, you know, have giant ego circle jerks. I did not do that. It's not what I voted for. I did not vote for petty infighting when we could be going after the left. I didn't vote for that, nor did you. I mean, my gosh, people, I don't know if you realize, but this administration's got its work cut out for them. And everybody's all pitching together to make sure that it gets done. But you're not going to secure anything when you go after your most conservative fighters. I don't care if they kiss your ass or not. Do they vote for your agenda? He does. Chip Roy does. He has backed that agenda to the hilt. He's not an ass kisser. I'm not either. But we back the agenda that gets it done for voters. And that's what it's about. That's all it's ever been about. Why in the world is he doing this? Why? And no, Chip Roy is super popular in Texas. He's not going to go anywhere. Bob Good is a conservative stalwart. We had a hardcore conservative who got replaced by a moderate. We lost a hardcore conservative who stood shoulder to shoulder with you on everything from lower taxes to gun rights to everything. And he got replaced by a moderate because people decided they got mad at Bob Good because Bob Good, I don't care who you supported in the primary. If you're still litigating the primary, you are a walking mental abortion and you are everything that is wrong with this country. And I hope you have a crap Christmas. And I hope it's mean as I sound because I'm tired of this stuff. I'm tired of it. Get over, some of these people need to get over their fetish over the primary. It's weird. If you're still litigating the primary, you're anti-American. If you're still litigating the primary, you're a communist psyop. We all want lower taxes. We want to get rid of this DEI stuff. We don't want World War III. And by God, you're not going to get it done by having these petty ego fights. It's not going to happen. We voted for good Trump. I didn't vote for petty infighting. Stop it. Must have won every time of the year. Kane, go ahead. Oh, I just hurt my shoulder. All right. Again.
Well, you know, you always accuse me of having a tinfoil hat only because I have 10 of them. But listen to the chicks on The View here.
Oh, my gosh.
Juan, play this.
Who is in charge? Because I've been saying it for a while.
Yes, you have.
I've been saying that I think Elon Musk believes he's president.
What?
I do.
Well, you've been calling him vice president.
I've called him vice president. Yeah. I called him president because I don't know what JD is doing.
The gist of it is they think that Elon is and JD are plotting to get rid of Trump. Okay.
See, there's where the narrative starts.
Good Lord.
I told you that narrative's happening, right? They're going to try to divide and conquer. I told you that. And you know what? Going after our own conservative stalwarts isn't helping either. Folks, that does it for us today. Find us at Substack. I'll be back behind the mic with you tomorrow to finish out the week.